today on Against the Grain. What role can rage play in political struggle? Does it lead to irrational behavior and thoughtless action, or can it be a vehicle for social change? I'm CS. William Sokoloff examines rage and resistance in the context of the life and work of Frederick Douglass, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. There is a lot to be mad about. There's a lot of injustice and inequality and corruption and, well, the list goes on. We could rage against the machine, and many of us do, but where does that get us? Isn't rage blind? Doesn't it cloud our thinking and make us do things we regret later? And in the political arena, can't rage interfere with our ability to evaluate situations and respond in effective and strategic ways? William Sokoloff has done a lot of thinking about the role of rage in political resistance, and he argues in his new book, Confrontational Citizenship, that rage is a fundamental component of democratic citizenship. Focusing on Frederick Douglass, Sokoloff argues, in one chapter of his book, that Douglass inaugurated a tradition of political resistance and rage that can inform critical political consciousness today. William Sokoloff is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and his book's full title is Confrontational Citizenship: Reflections on Hatred, Rage, Revolution, and Revolt. When William joined me recently in studio, I asked him how mainstream traditions in political theory view rage in relation to democratic citizenship.
Rage is, historically speaking, not something that's appreciated by, I would argue, the entire tradition of Western political thought, with very few exceptions. Contemporary political science and scientists view the passions as something to be subdued, controlled, and annihilated in some cases. And the founding of the country is quite explicit about the need to restrain the passions, and I'm referring to some famous Federalist papers where the passions are actually viewed as a threat to law and order.
So in other words, concerns have arisen, and I imagine time and time again, about rage going out of control and people being led by the impulse of rage to do what, irrational things?
That's the traditional narrative, that rage leads to erratic behavior, criminal actions, and of course, sometimes we hear the expression road rage to refer to someone who has completely lost control in a situation that leads to violent forms of confrontation.
How have philosophers like Aristotle and Hobbes, what positions have they taken on rage?
Aristotle argues that intense feelings need to be held at bay or kept in their place. In the case of someone like Hobbes, you know, off the top of my head, I don't recall if he has a specific reference to rage, but he does talk in great deal about the passions, and specifically the ways in which the passions undermine the possibility of collective life. Hobbes argues that the fear that people have of each other in the state of nature needs to be replaced with fear of the sovereign or a strong leader. So I would say in the case of Hobbes, intense passions very much need to be controlled from above and subdued to ensure that citizens act, or in the case of Hobbes, subjects act in a very particular way, namely a way that it preserves law and order.
You've also looked at how Black intellectuals and intellectuals of color have approached the issue of rage. What thinkers have inspired you in terms of having you think anew about what rage is and what rage could be in a political sense?
Rage has been dealt in different ways by the African-American intelligentsia. And this is a complicated genealogy or history, But the two figures, at least for my study, that were absolutely essential to sort of bringing rage back to the center were bell hooks and Audre Lorde. I came across the writings of bell hooks really by chance. One of my students at a prior institution gave me a book, an amazing book, Teaching to Transgress. So I read the book, really blew my mind. And then after that, I decided I needed to read much more by bell hooks. Audre Lorde also was another thinker who I encountered by chance and made a very compelling case about the ways in which anger can actually be a productive component of democratic citizenship.
Let's turn to Frederick Douglass, as you do in one of your chapters in your new book, Confrontational Citizenship: Reflections on Hatred, Rage, Revolution, and Revolt. And let's just start with some basics. What key things should we know about Frederick Douglass and the struggle that he undertook?
Frederick Douglass, in my view, is a complete genius. He was born into slavery, and through a level of resilience that is truly astounding, managed to navigate his way through and eventually out of slavery. He taught himself how to read through clever interactions with white children that were being taught how to read. But of course, at this time, it was illegal for a slave to learn how to read. And Douglass also impressed me with the power of his voice. He wrote several autobiographies, and I don't believe that Douglass has received the recognition that he deserves. So really, one of the things I'm trying to do with this chapter is to make the case for the centrality of Frederick Douglass in a tradition of American political thought pertaining explicitly to the politics of rage.
You contend that rage was an important component of Frederick Douglass's political sensibility. Before we get to the rage that he expressed in various writings and situations, let me ask about the kind of rage that he experienced directed at him. What happened to him? And here, of course, I'm talking about certain white people and how they treated Frederick Douglass.
There are many stages of Frederick Douglass's life. His childhood, the time he spent on a slave plantation, the time he spent escaping, and then different locations where he lived in the North, as well as the time he spent out of the country. But I believe it was Pendleton, Indiana, where he was attacked by a mob and he lost the use of his right hand as a result of this. There are other incidents that I would encourage your readers to check out in his either his first, but I think more importantly, his second autobiography.
And what did he learn about rage and its efficacy and its political potential from just those encounters, from being the target of white mobs and their rage?
This is a complicated question, but I would say Douglass was angry about how he was treated, but he knew that he had to be very strategic and thoughtful about when he was going to resist, when he was going to escape. So he saw the destructive nature of the rage of slave owners and knew that he too was angry about how he was treated, but he had to be clever, tactical, and quite strategic in terms of his own response.
Douglass, at meetings of abolitionists, he spoke on stage and described his life as a slave. What role did rage play in his onstage presentations?
Douglass was an amazing speaker. And if you look at his collected works, the most memorable writings, in my view, are his autobiographies, but also his speeches. And of course, one of the most famous speeches is the meaning of the 4th of July to the Negro. At the abolitionist meetings that you're referencing, C.S., Douglass gave speeches to audiences to enlighten people about the horrors of slavery. So This is Douglas at his finest in terms of his rhetorical capacity. So Douglas was angry, but he channeled this anger and rage, I argue, into speeches and rhetorical strategies that sought to enlighten his audiences as well as share the intense injustice that he experienced with them.
And how did he see rage and the uses it would have for him on stage? How did he view its efficacy compared with, say, him just making some kind of a rational, reasoned argument about slavery to his audience?
The problem with a strictly logical or rational argument about the horror of slavery is no one really cared about the viewpoint of a black person. So Douglas had to shatter a certain resistance to listening, a certain resistance to being able to see the world from the vantage point of a slave. So Douglas deployed a very strategic rhetorical strategy to try to, in a sense, assist his audience see the world from his perspective.
So you said earlier that Frederick Douglass tried to learn how to read. So this is, you know, he was a young person and a slave, and he was prevented from doing so. So what happened, and what did he conclude from his owner's desire that Douglass not learn how to read?
It confused Douglass. At first, he wasn't sure why anyone would want to prevent him from reading. But the more he thought about it, the more he realized that any oppressed group or person that acquires the capacity to think becomes threatening to these oppressive structures. Through this conclusion, Douglass realized that a literate slave would be ungovernable, uncontrollable, and a threat to this oppressive system.
What writings did he gravitate toward once he learned how to read? And at one point, he tried to teach other slaves how to read the Bible. Tell us about that episode.
So Douglass didn't have access to a library, to bookstores. There were very few things that he could access. So the Bible was definitely something that was fairly common. So he read the Bible as well as some materials pertaining to the founding of the United States. Douglass tried to read the Bible with other slaves, but he was prevented from doing so by a small mob of white people, and this shocked him. He thought that the message of Christianity was something that mattered very much to white people, so why should black people or African Americans be prevented from learning the gospel? So this, yet again, strengthened Douglass's determination to not only find ways to escape, but it also revealed to him the hypocrisy of what he called white Christianity that was loose-lipped in its preaching of virtue and holiness, but couldn't see the ways in which it was an oppressive system of domination in terms of his treatment of African Americans.
That's William Sokoloff. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. We're talking about his new book, Confrontational Citizenship, Reflections on Hatred, Rage, Revolution, and Revolt. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. The meaning of July 4th for the Negro, you cited it earlier, by Frederick Douglass, given in Rochester, New York in 1852. What was his message in that talk, and how did he deploy rage in that presentation?
Douglass wanted Americans to try to see the ways in which the 4th of July and the attendant celebrations represented yet again another form of hypocrisy, because the ideals articulated in the Declaration of Independence were not extended to African Americans. This troubled Douglass in a very deep manner. So this speech is Douglass's attempt to try to get white America to see what these celebrations mean when you're excluded from the celebration. And in this speech, I would argue that Douglass deploys rage as a rhetorical strategy with intense mockery, sarcasm, irony, really a way of verbally shaking someone by the shoulders and really asking them, pleading with them, why can you not see what's right in front of you? Why can you not see what you're doing? Why are you blind to your own hypocrisy?
And rage in this context, do you think that he thought that it would help him get through to people, that a sense of visceral emotion or the use of visceral emotion or the display of visceral emotion would have a greater impact?
C.S., this is a great question about what I would call the politics of pedagogy in Douglass, that learning is not something that happens at a distance, that is simply a cerebral exercise. As you put it, C.S., learning very much has a visceral dimension, and Douglass, in a sense, wanted to use all means necessary to trigger a shift in perspective amongst a population that was completely blind to the suffering of people of color in the United States. And yes, he's going to use shocking examples. Yes, he is going to accuse. Yes, he is going to use sarcasm and mockery. Of course, the risk was it could trigger an attack against Douglass himself. And yes, this unfortunately did happen. But Douglass was not going to back down. He was not going to succumb to fear. He had a cause. It was a righteous one. And it organized his whole life.
Rage also played a role in Frederick Douglass's encounter with a man named Edward Covey, a slave breaker who Douglass's master sent Frederick Douglass to. What did Covey do to Douglass?
Covey worked him to death and then flogged him, whipped him, and it was a time that was a very dark time for Douglass where he came close to losing the will to live. But he survived this. And not only did he survive, but he decided that Covey was going to get what he deserved. So, of course, this was a very risky move on Douglass's part, but he fought Covey. And I would say this is without doubt one of the high points of his autobiographies, where he recounts in great detail this battle against the slave breaker. So Douglass is very strategic and tactical. So someone could say, yeah, if he fights the slave breaker is going to shoot him and it's going to be over. But Covey, according to Douglass, had a reputation to preserve as a slave breaker, that Covey profited off this reputation, that other slave owners sent difficult slaves to Covey so Covey could domesticate them and make them, quote unquote, good slaves. So Douglass knew this dynamic was in play, and Douglass took this into account and decided that he had had enough and it was time to fight Covey, and he did.
So in other words, the 16-year-old Douglass, he knew that Covey didn't want to be known as a slave killer, right, but rather as a slave breaker. So he decides to, at one point on one day, in front of other slaves, right, in front of his fellow slaves, he fights Covey. So are you saying that Douglass won that fight? And how did Douglass feel after that fight with Covey?
Douglass definitely won the fight. Douglass, though, was strategic in the fight in terms of adopting more of a defensive stance, I would say, as opposed to, say, breaking Covey's neck or something like that, which he did not do. The slaves that observed Douglass fighting Covey simply stood there. Covey called for their help, and they simply stood there. So this is a very powerful moment of solidarity between Douglass and other slaves. Other slaves were not going to come and rescue Covey. Additionally, this fight for Douglass, as he puts it in his autobiography, kindled the spirit of liberty in him. He acquired, as a result of this struggle with Covey, a new level of self-confidence. And Douglas is very clear in the autobiography, this was a very new feeling, that actually fighting back, actually taking action against Covey, gave Douglas a level of dignity that he had hitherto never experienced.
So what does Douglas's fight with Covey demonstrate to you about the value of rage, the political value and uses of rage?
This fight illustrates to me that rage was not something blinding or irrational with Douglas. That although Douglas had been brutalized for weeks under Covey's domination, Douglas was very tactical and strategic about exactly how he was going to resist and fight Covey. So in this case, I would say rage is a dialectical emotion that is triggered by abuse, but Douglas, I wouldn't say subdued the rage, but channeled it into a political tactic of revolt.
What do you mean by dialectical?
Dialectical is a complicated word with a complicated history. But in this case, I would say that Douglas experienced a strong visceral reaction to slavery and transformed this feeling into a way of fighting back, but not in a reactive or knee-jerk manner. So I wouldn't say that Douglas subdues rage dialectically, but transforms it into a strategy of resistance against oppression.
What did Frederick Douglass learn about what slavery did to habituate the slaves to be dominated, to incline them to participate in their own domination?
C.S., this is a great question, and I'm really glad you're asking me this. It's something that has a level of political relevance today that I would say is quite high. Oppressive orders need cooperation from the oppressed, and there are a number of ways that they can accomplish this. They can convince oppressed people that there's no alternative to oppression, that oppression is the present and the future. And the way that oppressive orders do this is through eliminating the capacity to imagine anything different. Another strategy is what I would refer to as distract and dominate. So oppressed groups become distracted with something else. Perhaps they're fighting amongst themselves as opposed to identifying their real enemy, which is, of course, the oppressive system and the people behind it. So Douglas had a very clear analysis of the politics of the slave plantation, the ways in which slaves were pitted against each other, the ways in which slave owners offered slaves alcohol to get them drunk so they became incapable of resistance, the ways in which the slave plantation and its oppressors simply told the slaves and reminded them every day that this was it, this is reality, get used to it. And C.S., it's a horribly brutal story, but on the slave plantation, children were taken from their parents as a way to shape the children into good slaves and to deprive the children of the type of nurturing that would lead to their self-confidence and sense of dignity as human beings. So Douglas had a very keen awareness of the various ruses and ways in which the slave plantation was a totalizing system, but Douglas was very aware of the cracks in the system, of the openings for resistance, and as we all know, Douglas escaped.
What role did deception and surveillance play on the plantation?
Slaves needed to be watched. They needed to be kept in their place. And today we have cameras everywhere. You can't make a move without it being videoed. In the case of Douglas, the slave owners needed to give the slaves a sense that they were always being watched. So Covey, for example, was hiding behind every bush at the same time to make sure that slaves knew they made a move, someone was there watching it.
Did slave owners like their slaves talkative or quiet?
A quiet slave scared slave owners. They didn't know what was going on in their mind, what they were thinking about. A gregarious slave was reassuring to slave owners, at least according to Douglas in his autobiographies, because it comforted the slave owners that at least they knew what was going on in the minds of their slaves. It was the interior silence and non-talkative slave that was viewed with suspicion, according to Douglas.
The book is Confrontational Citizenship. The author, my guest, is William Sokoloff. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. We'll take a short break and speak more with William about his book, about Frederick Douglass, and some of the other chapters in this interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. William Sokoloff teaches political science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and his new book is Confrontational Citizenship, Reflections on Hatred, Rage, Revolution, and Revolt. In that book, he discusses, among other figures, important figures, Frederick Douglass, the freed slave, the abolitionist, the amazing orator and activist. So you write that many thinkers cast Frederick Douglass as an activist who was not militant enough. Despite everything you're saying, William, they don't consider him militant enough. Who are they comparing Douglass to?
I found that many of the scholars I read who had written on Douglass, you know, viewed him as a pragmatist. They said he wasn't very radical, that John Brown was much more radical. John Brown came to Douglass for support, and Douglass refused. You know, I don't want to get into all the details of this moment, but...
But we should say that John Brown was the abolitionist who believed that armed insurrection was the way to end slavery in the U.S., and he led the famous raid at Harper's Ferry. There was an armory there. He was trying to get weapons from this facility in Virginia in this effort to spark a slave rebellion. So John Brown is considered sort of by many to be the paradigm of sort of radical revolutionary abolitionists.
That's correct. So Douglass, I think, at least had a very clear sense that the path John Brown was taking would not go well. And Douglass was right about that. Douglass, in my view, is a thoughtful activist, very strategic, very tactical, who is not going to go to the extreme of armed rebellion for a variety of reasons. In the case of John Brown, Douglass had a sense that John Brown's attempt would fail and John Brown would be put to death, and he was.
And so what do you see Frederick Douglass as offering us today? How can his experience of and use of rage help us today, either in fashioning a political consciousness or in choosing certain political actions over others?
I would say first and foremost, if in the current political climate and situation, if we're not angry at least a little bit right now, something might be wrong with us. There are just on a day-to-day basis very shocking revelations pertaining to police brutality, official corruption, the influence of money in politics, this horrendous shooting in Sacramento. And it just goes on and on. And I think Douglas invites us to very carefully analyze the situation and try to channel the intense emotions we may be experiencing in productive and strategic political directions.
And certainly one of those emotions is rage. And so rage, as you said before, is not to be, at least according to Douglas and according to you, not to be suppressed as much as it is to be channeled in some direction, in a direction of what, self-reflection and thoughtful conduct?
Definitely. So, of course, the charge could be made against me that I'm simply doing exactly what Aristotle and other thinkers have said about rage, but that's not the case because aspects of Douglas's rage do come out, but it's always in very precise ways. So, you know, the examples that we've discussed are the ways in which he performs his rage at abolitionist meetings, the way he invokes rage in sarcasm, mockery, and irony in the famous 4th of July speech, the way that Douglas draws on his rage to articulate a critique of slave plantation politics. So rage was something very complicated in Douglas that led to a variety of actions. And of course, I left out the ways in which rage propelled Douglas to fight Covey. But again, it wasn't a fight that was going to lead to Douglas's death, although he could never be sure completely about that. But my point really is that rage motivated Douglas in a variety of ways that I think could lead to thoughtful reflection today about the ways in which public anger can be channeled for potentially productive political ends.
Now, we've been spending quite a bit of time on just one chapter of your new book, Confrontational Citizenship, William. And I want to ask you about some other things that stood out to me in that book. Chapter one, for example, is titled In Defense of Hatred. What kind of hatred are you defending?
Thanks for the question. And I am aware that this is a rather provocative title for a chapter. One of the problems, I think, in today's politics is that elites and people in power have manipulated others into hating certain groups. So, for example, immigrants have been targeted quite explicitly by President Trump, not only during his campaign, but during his time in office. And I would argue that these are forms of misplaced hatred. So the argument I make draws on the work of Machiavelli, but has a very practical political relevance to the contemporary context, which is there are good reasons the people in the United States should hate not immigrants, not people on welfare, not the homeless, not people who have a drug addiction, but actually the people in power. The people who are profiting off of oppressive systems and the lack of democracy. So the argument I make is that hatred of elites, at least according to Machiavelli, serves a valuable function in terms of elite accountability to the people.
In other words, making elites accountable, or elites need to worry about that kind of hatred and therefore act more responsibly?
Exactly. They need to worry about it. However, elites have been very effective in directing people's attention to other objects of hatred, whether it is a foreign power, say North Korea, or the amorphous threat of international terrorism, or immigrants, or other demonized groups. They're doing this, Machiavelli would argue, to keep the people from hating them. So it's a form of distract and dominate through a very carefully crafted politics of hatred. So Machiavelli teaches us that popular hatred of elites is actually the real mechanism of accountability.
Now, hatred can fuel protest, political protest, but sometimes, and in fact often, it appears that protest does not lead to a change in government policy. A lot of people wonder then, why should I go out and demonstrate if it won't have an impact, if the regime doesn't care, doesn't appear to care what the people think?
There's an argument that's frequently made that if protest doesn't have an immediate positive outcome, that it was a big waste of time. And I actually take issue with this argument. I think this is the wrong approach. Protest is a way that people can relate to each other, learn from each other, and establish connections that create a democratic culture. And this is something that's not created overnight. In a political situation, say that we have in the United States, where political activity is defined as voting, and that takes place, you know, once or twice every 4 years, the consequence of that is a destruction of democratic culture. In contrast, a culture where protest is taking place on a more regular basis, granted, it might not lead to immediate change, but it's definitely going to send a message to the leaders that they're being watched and that the people are not happy and the people are going to learn from each other. So what I'm saying is there's a certain pedagogy to protest where there's an ongoing learning that's taking place, and the learning is also taking place, you know, for the leaders who are coming to the realization that they simply cannot get away with their secret deals, with their corruption, that they're being watched.
Identity politics, and you take this up in your book as well, has been criticized by many thinkers and activists as divisive and counterproductive. What's your take on that?
As you stated, I teach in Deep South Texas at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and the majority of my students are Latino and Latina, roughly 97% of the student population. And it's quite common amongst academics to claim that we need to emphasize, you know, what we have in common, and that we don't want every different group asserting some sort of tribal identity, that it will lead to fragmentation and a sort of impossible political situation. I actually think this is a mistake, because identity constructions in a lot of cases are the result of historical forms of oppression. And you can't tell people to forget about how they've been treated and jump on some bandwagon where the common is emphasized. The struggles and abuses endured by various ethnic minorities fuel their involvement in politics and allow people to learn from each other through their conversations and engagement. To ask that people simply put this stuff aside, I think, is definitely the wrong direction.
Who was Gloria Anzaldúa, and why do you focus on her work in making the case that identity claims are good, are productive as sources of political motivation?
Gloria Anzaldúa was a student at the University of Texas Pan American, which is the prior name for UTRGV, and wrote an amazing book called Borderlands La Frontera. And in this book, Anzaldúa shows how identity and reclaiming one's voice is a source of political strength. But Anzaldúa wasn't a narrow nationalist. She invented identity formations that allowed individuals to speak in their own voice, but also interact and form coalitions with others. And she makes a very compelling argument that identity, properly understood, she has a very particular conception of it, is actually a way to empower individuals so they can reclaim their voice, write their own narrative, and work with others in very productive ways.
It's a kind of identity that stresses interconnection as opposed to separatism, right?
Absolutely.
You conclude your book by advocating for a culture of resistance. What's that?
A culture of resistance would be a political society that justifies its decisions through popular participation, through inclusion of the voices of ordinary people in decision-making and in political power. Unfortunately, political regimes, once they're institutionalized, grow increasingly separate from the people and find ways to exclude the people. You know, there are a lot of complicated arguments I make in the book, but really it all comes down to the people being active participants in constructing a better political future. And at the end of the day, this all boils down to activism, protest, civil disobedience, and making sure their voices are heard. In the chapter on W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, I argue that he has a very unique conception of revolt as a way of life. So what I would say in conclusion is that protest has to become a way of life. And my hope is that this puts a bit of fear into elites and encourage them to listen much more carefully to the voices of the people.
William Sokoloff is his name, S-O-K-O-L-O-F-F, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and he is Associate Editor of the journal New Political Science. We've been discussing his new book. It's called Confrontational Citizenship, Reflections on Hatred, Rage, Revolution, and Revolt. It's published by SUNY Press. Congratulations on the book, William, and thanks so much for joining me.
C.S., thanks so much for the invite. I really enjoyed it.
I'm C.S. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And in the time we have remaining, I want to present portions of two interviews, portions that were never aired because of time limitations. The first excerpt is from a conversation I had with Jonathan Simon, who you may have heard speak recently on Against the Grain, about how paying attention to human dignity and respect for human dignity might transform criminal justice in the U.S. Jonathan Simon is a professor at UC Berkeley School of Law, and here's a portion of that interview that I'm happy to present today for the first time. How do you view the criminalizing of the simple possession of items like drugs, and what would invoking dignity as a core value do to the criminalizing of those kinds of activities, in your opinion?
One of the ways that the war on drugs became such an effective way to mass imprison people was because it's very easy to convict people of drug crimes if, as is the case, drugs themselves are heavily concentrated as a commercial product in very poor neighborhoods where people have very little ability to keep them out, and where young people often find that either being in that business or even just physically around it is almost impossible to avoid. In that setting, it's simply not very hard for the police to establish that somebody was in a physical place in enough proximity to some drugs that a court can decide that they were in possession of them. Possession is itself a fascinating crime. Typically, we say that a crime has to be a combination of a guilty mind, a mens rea, we call it, and a bad act. So you have to intend to do something wrong, and then you have to do something physically wrong. Well, ask yourself the following question. Is possession a bad act? Have you actually done anything? Typically, possessing drugs or, for that matter, a gun, is not itself a harm to anyone. It's what you're intending to do with it or what you do with it.
And it's almost like you're anticipating, by criminalizing possession, you're anticipating a bad act using this material, using that item.
Exactly. And when you combine it with how discriminatory enforcement is, you get this double whammy. You're both prejudging people's antisocial intent by basically taking their possession as a proxy for their criminality. And you're doing it in open knowledge of the fact that it's racially demarcated who gets put through this exposure. I like to use the following hypothetical with my students because I often have a party for my criminal law students at my house. And so I imagine that after the party's over, I'm cleaning up my backyard and I find a baggie of, say, cocaine, because I guess weed's now legal, so it doesn't help the hypo. But if I find a baggie of cocaine, what am I supposed to do? So if I'm holding the bag, now I'm in possession of it. According to the typical penal codes, possession means being aware that you have control of something for long enough to get rid of it. So now what am I going to do? I could put it in my garbage can, but actually it's still on my property, so I'm still in control of it. So I guess I'm still in possession of it. I could put it in my neighbor's garbage can. Now I've implicated him in a drug crime. I could drive to the police station, but what if I'm stopped on the way to the police station and they find the cocaine on me? So you can kind of see how this quickly, you know, you might say, well, that never happens. But I think the reality is it happens all too often to people who live in neighborhoods that are, you know, saturated with drugs. And, you know, drugs can be a serious harm. I think we ought to move toward a approach of treating drugs the way we treat pollution. It's a kind of a nuisance. It's something that people ought to be held accountable for cleaning up if they have a drug problem. If there are drugs that are influencing other people in their community, they got to do something about that. But to treat them as presumptive criminals, and I'll alienate some of your listeners by saying I feel the same way about gun possession. You know, all too many people in this country find themselves feeling that they need a gun to protect themselves, sometimes in the poorest neighborhoods in America. And if they've been felonized, which many people of color have been, it becomes a serious felony just to have that gun in your house, even though you may be in your 50s or 60s and feel you need it to protect your family in that setting. And yet you've been declared, you know, you can spend 10 years in prison for that.
So if we do apply dignity, dignity as personal integrity, and perhaps dignity as collective virtue to this scenario, to this issue of simple possession and the criminalizing of it, is it a straight line toward decriminalization?
If we were going to address drugs and the threat that they sometimes pose to communities through criminal laws that respected human dignity, the human dignity of the people that we were holding accountable, I think what we would do is combine possession with what criminal lawyers would call other elements that go to the threat that's posed to the community. Like possessing drugs, you know, in a situation that endangers young people in the community, or possessing drugs in a setting that exposes neighbors to the risk of contamination or dosing, certainly in an age of opioid fear, that's not irrelevant. Notice that there's two things. One, it defines a harmful dynamic beyond just possession that the state has to prove, and that therefore is more respectful of the dignity of the person, because it doesn't say, well, we just assume you're going to do harm. We've proven that you were, you know, not just possessing, but you were possessing in ways that caused these additional dangers and that you knew it or you were aware of it and you could have done something about it. And the second thing we do, which is very important, is kind of the decent society side, is we give our neighbors on juries the opportunity to impose a moral filter on who they think should be punished for drug crimes. You know, the common law system developed the jury because we believe that ordinary people, not elites or experts, were in the best position to really understand the meaning of crimes that emerged from our common life together. And drug crime completely overrides that in favor of a technocratic crime that is basically for the police, by the police. You know, most drugs are some cycle back and forth between the police and the community and sort of convict people over and over again. And we could start talking about crime labs and what a sort of drug, you know, a kind of drug mess they often are, with addicted lab directors and, you know, very little controls of exactly who's using drugs or what drugs belong to which person. It's wholly disrespectful of individual responsibility or even due process.
That's Jonathan Simon, Adrian A. Cragen Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law. Another guest I had on recently was Eric Holt Jimenez, Executive Director of Food First. He joined me to discuss his new book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism: Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. Here, Eric Holt Jimenez talks about the characteristics of and trends within social movements, and particularly the food movement.
In general, what we have seen for decades now is the fragmentation of the left. And you know, the other side of this, it's been a problem of the left. I think there are a lot of things that the left did not address, patriarchy well, didn't address the issues of gender well, address the issues of class well, but not of race. And so, of course, other organizations and other communities are going to rise up and they're going to organize around these issues. And so we have tremendous political diversity on the left today, but we're fragmented both by issues and by our funding. So really the challenge to build a powerful food movement is to converge in all of this diversity and to repoliticize. So we remember that the problem really is capitalism here that reinforces all these different divisions. And we have to address these divisions head on. I mean, we have to address patriarchy. We have to address white supremacy, not just in the wide world or in the food system, but in our own movement, in our own organizations, and with our own selves as individuals. This isn't extra work to building a strong food movement or building a resilient and equitable food system. This is the work. I think if we don't do these things, we're not going to be able to converge. And if we can't converge, we won't be able to create the political will we need to transform the food system.
So you write about how books like those of Michael Pollan helped usher in a new kind of generation of foodies, right? They organize conferences, they flock to food festivals, they read about food, they watch documentaries about food, they make documentaries about food. What do you find encouraging about this, and what do you find not so encouraging?
Well, the food movement has sort of a mainstream. And that mainstream is very much informed by and has grown thanks to books like Omnivore's Dilemma and some of the more prominent researchers and authors, sort of the celebrity authors that we have within the food movement. And that's a good thing because more and more people are aware of the problems of the food system. The problem with this is that we don't hear the voices from the people on the front lines who are most negatively affected by the food system. Those are the voices we have to hear because that's where the insights around struggle and resiliency and equity and solidarity are all coming from. So that means that we need to look to the leadership and support the leadership of women and people of color and the peasantry and very, very poor family farmers to find a way out of this. And the reason is very simple. Aside from their insights, these are the people for whom giving up hope is not an option. They have nowhere else to go. And this is true globally. You look at the 2 billion peasants in the world, they have nowhere else to go. They've got to fight for this because migration is also a dead end. And so we need to make the countryside a good place to live. We need to bring food back into the city, food production back into the city. Instead of paving it over, we need to be growing food. And we need to be democratizing this food system in favor of the poor. That's what we call food sovereignty, which is quite different from food security. You can be food secure in jail. Food sovereignty means you have control over the food. And that's what we're fighting for.
A portion of my interview with Eric Holt Jimenez that we weren't able to broadcast previously. Eric's new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. If you want to listen to the full-length interview with Eric Holt Jimenez or with Jonathan Simon, visit our website, againstthegrain.org. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.